This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Baghdad blows up and actor Damon Wayans wants a controversial trademark. Joining us to discuss these topics and more from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael Myers joins us. He's executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. He's in our New York bureau. And from our Chicago bureau, Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender. All right, folks, thanks very much. We want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing going on, quite frankly, all over Iraq. Baghdad, again, ablaze with bombings and the like. Mary Frances Berry, we are seeing this insurgency not stepping back, but stepping forward in the face of what many believe is a growing quagmire for the Bush administration. Again, the word Vietnam is evoked constantly now.
Well, it is a quagmire. It has been for quite a while. And the problem also is getting good information. First, we were told that while this was bad, the death toll was very low. Then today we get some new figures that indicate that quite a number of 1,300 or more Iraqis have been killed in the last week. You wonder why the Interior Ministry and the military don't know that when the press can find that out. But in any case, whether Iraq is going to be divided up into Kurdish areas and Sunni areas and Shiite areas, the jury is out. Also, our hopes of getting the troops, or at least my hope and some other people, of getting the troops, American troops, to come home sometime soon. I even bet that they would start coming home this year. I'm still hopeful of that. Are somewhat in question now with what's going on there. So matters are worse. The government there doesn't seem to be getting organized. The Shiites control it, of course. They have the greatest number, but that doesn't answer the problem. And I don't know who in particular is responsible for particular violence, but I do think it's becoming more and more a, quote, quagmire.
Roland Martin, when you see this kind of instability in a growing way, one has to, in spite of it being an election year and talk of needing to pull the troops out for political reasons, if nothing else, one has to believe this is harder and harder to do. As Mary suggests, the government's not stable, the streets aren't stable. How do you do that?
Well, it is hard to do, but let's just simply be honest. Americans don't give a flip about 1,300 Iraqis being killed in the last week. I mean, let's just be honest about it. 2,292 U.S. military troops have died since March 2003. Clearly, and so you have 1,300 Iraqis died in the last week. We don't care about the Iraqis dying. And so that is not going to move the poll numbers anyway. The only way you're going to see the poll numbers move in America if you see the number of American troops go up. But certainly we are now in a difficult position. We can't leave. We cannot make that kind of decision, because you talk about now being destabilized. Simply imagine if you don't have those U.S. troops there doing whatever it is that they are doing. But no, we have no choice but to stay where we are, and that is the problem. We do not have any exit plan. We have not brought the Iraqi military up to snuff. Look, we're just going to continue spending billions and billions of dollars, and we're going to be there for a long, long period of time.
Michael Myers, we saw historically Lyndon Johnson start to understand, keep quiet, and then eventually cost him his presidency, but admitting that there was no easy way out of Vietnam and in many people's minds, no way to win that war. Can you liken any of what you see today to what you saw then?
Well, that was the back then with LBJ. We went from a democracy to an idiocracy, and I think that's what we have today. We have an American public that is mostly based on people who don't know what's going on. And it's difficult to know what's going on because the people who are in the know don't know. I think, Mary Frances Berry said, is it insurgency? Is it terrorism? Is it civil war? Who knows? What we know is a little bit of all of that, and it's probably all of that. So, 1,300 Iraqis haven't been killed since the Shrine attack is a large number. And then you have the U.S. Ambassador, Iraqi U.S. Ambassador Khalilzad, who said that the crisis is over, saying that, in effect, the civil war that they thought was going to happen had been averted. Well, he might as well have been standing on an U.S. aircraft carrier saying hostilities have ended. Nobody believes that. So the situation is out of our hands. It's out of control. And I don't know how many U.S. troops are going to have to be there or to die or to intervene or intercede between the different forces for this thing to be over. It's not going to be over. So we might as well pull out.
Roland made an excellent point, and so did Mike. Michael, your point's excellent, too. But Roland made an excellent point about the troops, American troops, and as long as we avoid casualties. One of the reasons why I believe the American troops have not tried to intervene between the Shiites and the Sunnis and whoever else is creating the violence is because they don't want to risk, the higher-ups don't want to risk more American casualties. But the American, because they know what Roland said, that if the numbers go up of Americans, then you've got more of a political problem. But if this violence continues, there's going to be some point at which Americans aren't going to be able to just stand by and see it happen, and then there will be even greater political risk. So it is becoming a very risky quagmire.
If the reason you don't have such a comparison to Vietnam is that Vietnam was not cloaked in the umbrella of terrorism. Last week, when it came to the port issue with Dubai, the president told Americans, don't you worry about security. In essence, we got this. You don't worry about it. Just going back to doing what you're doing. And so when you cloak everything in terrorism, that is this safety net for Americans that just take it easy. It's terrorism. That's why we're doing this. It's okay. With Vietnam, it was this interest of the U.S. kind of talk. You don't have the same type of emotion on the U.S. side that you had with Vietnam.
Except that the people on the receiving end of U.S. bombs felt they were terrorized.
And I understand the receiving end, but I'm speaking in terms of why Americans are responding the way they do, and we have not put the public pressure on the government to remove
it. Let me move us forward, because one of the things that we've seen through the Bush administration, and quite frankly, every presidential administration during war times, is a sanitized version of war. And that leads us to our next story, and that is whether or not you sanitize history for young children. It's a debate going on based on a 20-minute interactive film that's being played in the children's wing at the Rosa Parks Library and Museum. It's being overseen by Troy University, a Detroit-based institution. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of whether or not you should sanitize what has happened. We should note in this 20-minute interactive film, some of the characters speak in post-antebellum slave dialect. There's a jumping Jim Crow scene that shows a white man in blackface to tell the minstrel stories and how it purported stereotypes of African Americans. There was an objection over the use of the N-word in a script, and it was therefore changed, sanitized a bit to slightly change it and taken out in one instance. Roland Martin, what do you do when you talk about historical context and young people?
As a child growing up, I never watched a sanitized Holocaust film. As a child growing up, thank God I did not get to see sanitized versions of those newsreels of black kids being hosed down in the civil rights movement. And thank God I also saw people actually using the N-word in speaking about African Americans. I think it is wrong when you sanitize it. I disagree with the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development. I think we do a disservice when we do not put history in its proper context. And so I don't think we have to sanitize our kids. One of the reasons why kids today, and now you have adults today, who don't think a lot of these things happen is because they never saw it. They didn't experience it, but they never saw it. They never read it. And so we do a huge disservice when we take it to these lengths.
I agree with Roland, absolutely. And I think that we wouldn't have so much ignorance about things like the N-word, which is another topic, if people were actually to see the context in which all these things happened. The children who lived during the Civil Rights Movement and who lived during Jim Crow had to experience, and they saw all of these things. Children experienced it. They saw it. They felt it. They knew it. And so if children are going to get any understanding of history, and the best way to teach history is to make the images as vivid as possible and so that people can really feel that they connect and then they can apply that understanding to their own lives.
Well, what of the argument, Michael Myers, that there's a certain age that you should start to kick in reality, that for very young kids that perhaps a more sanitized version is better?
I don't know how you do a sanitized version. I think you had unanimity on the panel. I the only sanitized version you can have is parents not taking their kids to the museum, or parents not turning on the TV and allowing their children to watch Roots or any real documentary as opposed to a fictionalized story. The irony is, as suggested, is that children were a pivotal part of the civil rights protest and movement and demonstration. You had children who faced down these water hoses. You had children who integrated the schools amidst racial epithets and threats of violence and spitting and the ugliest of signs. These were the children who marched and who were the part of the civil rights movement. This was not just history, this is reality. So the question is, what is truth? And you have to have a rigorous pursuit of the truth. And you cannot shield children from the truth.
But you've got to have dialogue as well. And so I have 9 nieces and 2 nephews. And so when we sit down with them and we watch these videos, and we've got a ton of them, and we watch these documentaries, there's actual conversation, because they'll say, well, Uncle Roro or Mommy or Daddy, why did this happen? We'll say, because this is how they viewed us. This is what was said. We actually walk them through that so they can understand that. And so if you don't do that, you're sending your kids out in a world where the people who are opposing them or who are speaking ill of them, they know the history and they are using certain words, and now you have kids coming home saying, well, Mommy, a kid at school called me the N-word. What's that? I mean, and you have kids who are wholly ignorant of what's going on, and so now they are confused about how people are perceiving them.
Mary Frances Berry, that's the real key, the idea that often we're not teaching our kids history, sanitized or otherwise.
You've got a couple of problems. One is, it's true that parents who know their children better than anyone else can decide whether their child is too young to go to the museum. That's their decision. But it's also true that parents in the African-American community, especially, I found that in the post-civil rights generation, most of them, their parents haven't told them anything, or they haven't understood anything about what has happened and have no context. Mm-hmm. There's a Yoruba proverb which says that if you do not know the path from which you came, you do not know where to go. And people have said that in many different ways, and that's true. And so we've got this generation that doesn't know very much, and if they would go to the museum, they might understand something.
Let me do this in the fine means of sanitizing. I am going to warn people that just for a moment, we're going to say a word that may be offensive. So get ready to turn your radio down if you find the N-word offensive, because I have to use a version of it. The actor Damon Wayans has been engaged in a 14-month trademark fight to use the term nigga, N-I-G-G-A, for a clothing line and a retail store that he wants to bring about. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office at this point has turned him down, suggesting that there is a law that prohibits marking immoral and scandalous kinds of language to use as trademarks. Uncle Roro, what do you think about this?
I would tell, I ain't got a problem with that. I would tell Damon Wayans that he is being, that's what he's being. If you want to trademark the word, see, Damon Wayans, let's use some sense. If you want to trademark the word so you own the rights to it, which means you can take it out of circulation, being printed on other stuff, that's different. But to sit here and suggest that you want to launch a clothing line and a retail store celebrating this kinds of words shows me the high level of ignorance that come emanating from Damon Wayans. This is ridiculous. And clearly he didn't watch any videos or didn't watch any kind of historical perspectives on what has happened to our people. This is nonsense.
Michael Myers, there are those who make the argument that what they have done is taken the power away from the word for being offensive. We've heard that argument for years now.
Well, look. Damon Wayans is not the first one to try to trademark the word nigga. I mean, in 2001, a fellow named Keon Rodin tried to get the trademark office to okay his application to register a nigger for a clothing situation. So Damon Wayans is late getting to the trademark office. Isn't Damon Wayans the guy who, on Living Color, who used to have that Homie the Clown character, and his response was, Homie, don't play that. Well, the trademark office is saying to Damon Wayans, Homie, we don't play that. We're not going to trademark nigga. And so, tough. You're in a bad situation. So go and try and make your money elsewhere in some other way. But he's late getting to the trademark office.
Mary?
As far as the use of the word nigga, it's such common usage now that you know, I say you can't ban words, but you don't have to necessarily trademark them either.
I think the genie is out of the bottle on using the word, but giving it a trademark gives it a certain kind of status that is acceptable. And therefore, I would be opposed to a trademark. And I just wonder if Damon Wayans, if he understands why he wants to do this. But I think the genie's out of the bottle. People are going to continue to use it. It's been used, whether it's in hip-hop music or even Boondocks has had, you know, put it in the mouth of Martin Luther King, but to make a point. So that I think what we need to do is teach our people and our children more about the history and the context of this. And if they buy the word, know what they're doing. But I don't think we're going to stop the use of it.
Well, in terms of fluency of language.
And teach them some self-respect.
But in terms of fluency of language, nigger does not mean what nigger meant. And in today's population, today's younger population culture, it is a popularized, commonly used phrase.
All right.
You know what, Michael?
I got to hold it there. We'll get into the nuances.
They know what that means.
Guys, I got to hold it there. We'll get into the nuances of the N-word a little later. Mary Frances Berry, Michael Myers, Roland Martin, I thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.